This is Transported. We're over 100 days into the Israel-Hamas conflict now, and shortly we will hear from the ICJ about South Africa's petition that Israel is committing a genocide against the Palestinian people. The South African case is spurious and vexatious on its face. This shouldn't surprise us at all. In the current climate, we have moved from the classic big lie of Goebbels to the so-called pro-Palestinians telling dozens and dozens of small lies daily, and not just conventional lies, but inversions of the truth that are so sick and distorted that any individual one of them should be enough that most people would question the entire pro-Palestinian narrative. And we know, of course, that they don't. This is, to a large degree, because of confirmation bias, where you have your existing set of beliefs and any new information that comes to light must be either discounted or discredited or manipulated so that you can continue to hold those same beliefs. In debating what's going on in Gaza, such people tend to revert to "have you stopped beating your wife yet" kind of questions. And of course, the Israeli-Palestinian version of Godwin's law being when you resort to a Hitler comparison as early as possible in an online debate, of playing the dead baby Trump card. So if you feel that you're not able to discredit or defeat your Zionist interlocutor, all you have to do is show a picture of or scream about a dead baby being pulled from some rubble somewhere, and that's the end of the argument. Don't you believe that Israel shouldn't bomb babies? Do you think that? You understand, everyone's seen these videos, everyone knows the narrative by now. Indeed, it doesn't escape my attention that the entire use of the word genocide for something that clearly isn't a genocide, the use of that word is itself one of these needling attacks on Jews. Genocide as a phrase was brought into being by a Jewish jurist after the Second World War to provide a word to articulate the horrors of the Holocaust and to create a phrase that could be used legalistically in efforts by the world community to ensure that such a thing did not happen again. It's not a coincidence that the pro-Palestinians are super quick to use the word genocide, and they know where that word comes from, and they know what its connotations are. Something I find very interesting is that whilst the Palestinian case tends to be a series of canards and straw man cases against Israel, the case that I would make for the Palestinians would look entirely different. My steel man argument for the Palestinians would be something far more positive, interesting, based on facts and reality, and to also have some credible chance of actually happening and to not entirely be at the expense of Israel and indeed of the Jews. Herein, I think we find what the rub is. They're not trying to argue a case that is more than the sum of its parts. Most pro-Palestinians are not also capable of being pro-Israeli, whereas most pro-Israelis that I've ever met are quite capable of simultaneously being pro-Palestinian. It's not even cognitive dissonance, it's understanding that the best case for Israel is one in which there is a form of right for Palestinians to go about their lives in dignity and with self-determination. You can, like someone like Naftali Bennett, stop short of calling it a Palestinian state, you can stop short of giving certain trappings of statehood, but the idea of Palestinian dignity is actually fairly front and center in 95% of the minds of Israeli politicians. And yes, I know, unfortunately, the other 5% are particularly ugly in their language and particularly outspoken, and of course, remarkably likely to have a convenient Western journalist right there thrusting a microphone in front of them to make sure that every piece of dripping bile that comes from their mouth is recorded and amplified as far as possible. So in this podcast, I am going to fight fire with fire, and I know that this is going to be quite a tricky thing to do, and I'm also well aware that if, God forbid, this should go viral, as in any further than my friends and family, and I should cross the magical boundary of 100 people listening to my podcast, this might get me in some trouble, and I'm going to take that chance anyway. I will just point out from the beginning that the TikTok generation who are only capable of listening to a 30-second soundbite will be the people who misquote, because they'll be incapable of sitting through a half hour or an hour, as this podcast probably will run to, where I try and unpack the case that I'm going to make. Using the tenuous logic that the South Africans have taken to the ICJ, which we know exactly which countries are behind, and we know that Hamas are extremely approving of, and so are the Palestinian Authority, the definition of genocide has been contorted. And I am going to use their arguments to explain why I believe that Israel should carry out a form of genocide against Palestine. I'm just going to pause a moment while you wipe up the tea you just spilled. Yep, I really did just say that. And now I will explain. The Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide defines genocide as follows. Acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group through the acts of killing members of the protected group, causing them serious bodily or mental harm, imposing living conditions intended to destroy the group, preventing births, and forcibly transferring children out of the protected group. Victims must be targeted because of their real or perceived membership of a protected national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. One of the core complaints of South Africa against Israel is that senior members of the Knesset, including the government and what turned out to be the war cabinet, made statements that sounded genocidal. For example, Yoav Gallant, we are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly. Avi Dichter, this should be Gaza's Nakba. Ariel Kalner, there is one goal, Nakba, a Nakba that will overshadow the Nakba of 1948. Nakba in Gaza, and Nakba to anyone who dares to join. And so on and so on. We also know, of course, of the reference to Amalek by Netanyahu and others. It's quite interesting how many people outside the Jewish community have suddenly become expert biblical scripture and know all about what Amalek means to the Jewish people then and now. What is abundantly clear is that all but the most rabid of Knesset members have been speaking about Hamas, not all Palestinians. It is the other side of this debate that has, when convenient, decided that everybody is a Palestinian and there's no distinction, and that all actions Israel are taking are somehow collective punishment of Palestinians, not just trying to go after Hamas. And in fact, it's obvious that going after Hamas will involve harming other people. That is a fact of war. It doesn't make it a war crime. And these are complex and nuanced things that are happening. Nobody that I know, and very few even on the hardest of hard right, are crowing over the deaths of genuine civilians. But what we do know is that there are many shades of grey, especially in Gaza. There's no such thing, in my view, as a 100% adult civilian in Gaza. It's very hard to find one. And I'm saying that because we know, for example, that, oh, wow, the attacks on all of these journalists and all these dead journalists. And then, of course, you find that these dead journalists were photographed carrying out acts on October the 7th. Or, oh, the poor school teachers. And then it turns out that there is a group of 3,000 of them on Telegram, all working for the UN Relief Works Agency, sharing and crowing over events of October the 7th, and so on. That's not to say that these people are also 100% terrorists. It's not to say that they're all fair game. It's to say that there are shades of grey. It is the other side that refuses to accept that there are shades of grey, and what they are doing as a result is putting a target on the backs of everybody in Gaza. Because it is quite clear to anyone with half a brain cell and any sense of morality that Israel simply cannot accept the idea that it has no right to self-defence, because some of these people may be a bit less Hamasi than others. That's not how it works. I don't need to go over why Hamas are the representative of the people of Gaza, the fact that they were elected to do so many years ago, the fact that they continue to have the majority support even after the 7th of October, the fact that the majority of Gazan adults support, according to sophisticated opinion polls taken by serious Arab institutions, They would like to see more October the 7th. They believe it is a winning strategy, and they think that they are going to achieve their end goal of not a one-state solution where some Jews are there, but a one-state solution where they're fully in charge and they're essentially Judenrein. Again, their political opinions do not make them legitimate targets for the IDF to take out, but it is to make the point that this is an organization with overwhelming support. It could not have carried out October the 7th, it could not have held this number of hostages, and it could not have remained in power for the better part of a generation without that kind of support. Now you have to bear in mind what it is that people are supporting. They have supported the foulest acts of pogrom level, rape, mutilation, torture, the way in which we know that these hostages have been kept in cages, they've been abused. There is a level of sickness and depravity that runs through not just the acts of October the 7th, but what has happened subsequently, and the level of support and the willingness to go through all of this bombing and all of this destruction so that more October the 7th can be carried out. That suggests a deep sickness in probably Palestinian, but certainly Gazan society. In fact, no, I will say Palestinian society, because the opinion polls show that support for acts of October the 7th are even stronger in the West Bank. Because, of course, they haven't had all of the repercussions of the Israeli response to October the 7th. So people can get all screechy over Nakba. It's also quite an interesting phenomenon. Nakba is a catastrophe. The catastrophe of 1948 was, frankly, the catastrophe of the Arab nations failing to exterminate the Jews once and for all and to have the one-state solution of their dreams. It's rather unfortunate for them that the consequence of that was also the little Nakba of all of the refugees that were caused by Israel managing to survive. Nobody talks about, of course, all of the refugees of Arab countries, the Jews, moving to Israel and elsewhere as a direct consequence of having lived for thousands of years, in some cases, in Arab states, and then having the misfortune to be Jewish when the Jewish state was declared. The attempt to spread the word Nakba is, in my view, a direct and intentional attempt to conflate it in importance to Palestinian or Arab culture as the Shoah is to Jewish culture, and therefore that it should have concomitant support as a cause around the world with the Shoah for everybody else. This is just another example of the appropriation and diminution of language in the cause of the Palestinians. So this is why I am advocating that according to the way in which they themselves have described genocide and contorted it from its precise original definition, yes, we need to carry out a genocide. We need to destroy a national, ethnic, racial group, which is the Palestinians as they currently exist. I am not advocating killing members of that group. I am advocating what they consider for themselves to be serious mental harm against them. They need to be de-radicalized. They need to, in no uncertain terms, be separated from those of us who do not think that carrying out acts like October the 7th is just a call for freedom, or exhilarating, or what did you think decolonialization was going to look like? I believe in the same inverted commas genocide against all people who think that that kind of language is tolerable to excuse what happened on October the 7th, or that that is a format that is in any way an acceptable way to achieve your goals. And it's a genocide in the same way that whilst what we did in the Second World War was go after Nazi Germany, we were still going after Germany. Because at that point, the Nazis were in control of Germany, because the German people had, to some degree, elected them, and to a large degree, accidentally allowed them to take over the body politic, and then had failed to rise up as a nation in the 5 or 6 year period in which they could before the war to prevent that war from happening. And I level the same charge at the Palestinians. They have failed to remove Hamas. They've failed to remove the PA, who in many ways are just as radical with their pay-to-slay policies. And so, as far as I'm concerned, they are Hamastinians at this point. And whilst, yes, I'm going after the Hamas element, because of their own conflation of themselves with Hamas, then, yeah, this is going to look like, according to their definition, genocide. We must impose living conditions that are intended to destroy the group, and that is, according to the Genocide Convention and the claims that the South Africans are making, genocide. Bring it on. There must be living conditions which are intended to make it very clear that if you wish to hold this set of beliefs, there are repercussions that are unbelievably strong. And if we cannot work out who is a 100% civilian and who is a 100% terrorist, then we have no choice but to physically and totally separate you from us and from any ability of yourselves to rearm and carry out such acts again. And if that is your definition of genocide, yeah, okay, bring it on. Make the case, slap an ICJ charge against us, and watch Bibi, who at this point has nothing to lose because he's a busted flush as his political career goes anyway, watch him see through what we're doing in Gaza with the overwhelming support of all Israelis from left to right. Because only at this point, the most radical left believe, and I'm talking about the Israeli radical left here, obviously, that Hamas can stay in power and that somehow there will be a redemption of the Palestinian people in terms of their outlook and their behaviours. The only way this works is the removal of Hamas. Most world leaders in the West do still get this. They may wring their hands over the very sad killing of civilians, but I have yet to see, and believe me, I do keep an eye out for, an example of where Israel has intentionally aimed at civilians. It's quite obvious that mistakes will be made in war. We only have to look at the IDF admitting that 20% of the deaths of Israeli soldiers are as a result of friendly fire, which is to say that intent matters. And that is why it is very obvious that the behavior of the Palestinians as a collective is genocidal, because their intent is to destroy the group, the Jews, the Israelis. So when Ariel Kalner, a Likud member of the Knesset, says Nakba in Gaza and Nakba to anyone who dares to join, I say yes. Nakba against anyone who dares to join in the calumny of supporting Hamas and to claim in the name of being pro-Palestinian that that is somehow justified at this point because you think that Israel has killed too many civilians and you're claiming that either they intended to or that intent is irrelevant. It's interesting that intent is irrelevant to some of you most of the time, and yet for these cases to have any standing at the ICJ, intent is the exact thing you have to prove. Has this made some of you feel uncomfortable? I am arguing that you cannot have it both ways. You cannot continue to claim that you are being pro-Palestinian in calling for a ceasefire or for Hamas to remain in power. You cannot claim to be pro-Palestinian and at the same time denigrate the Israeli response, claim that you somehow know how they could do it better. You cannot belittle the acts of October the 7th, perhaps even claim that they were a false flag or that there was a stand-down order or any of the other myriad canards that you're probably quite familiar with, and then be uncomfortable when I point out that if you wish to continue to do all of those things, at which point what you have said, as far as I am concerned, is that all of those goals and those acts were done in the name of the Palestinians as a protected national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, as part of their raison d'etre, as part of the wider philosophy of Palestinian society, and that I should not say, if that is what that society is, I wish that society to cease to exist in its current form. The problem of the Palestinians for many years has been that making arguments on their behalf has involved being incredibly negative. Most pro-Palestinian arguments are in fact anti-Israeli arguments, and often based on straw men. If I were to make a positive pro-Palestinian case, if I were to steel man their position, I would use a totally different set of arguments. And I think there is a positive pro-Palestinian case. And it's always been bewildering to me as to how few people try to make it. In fact, it speaks volumes to the strength of their arguments and to the outcomes that the Palestinians and their supporters wish to achieve, though that isn't how they go about it. This same methodology is used in the current conflict. Instead of trying to make a positive case for Gaza as mostly peaceful Palestinians going about their business, not really in favor of the 7th of October, and therefore also keen to find a way to get rid of Hamas if they possibly could, all of which we know to not be true, it has been necessary to create myth upon myth upon myth to try and discredit the Israelis, undermine their position, and to get the world to stop them doing what is absolutely necessary and remove Hamas at whatever cost that may be. And there is no benefit to Israel of that cost being higher than it should be, but it is going to be high and is going to be necessary for them to see the job through. To give you some idea of the scale of the number of small lies and contortions and inversions that have taken place just in the past 110 or so days, I'm going to do a quick run through of 20 or 30 of them. I'll give each of them about 30 seconds. Number one, of course, Israel carried out a false flag operation. This whole thing was a setup. Despite the fact that transparently it wasn't, Hamas gleefully admitted to it. They took video footage. They planned it in advance. They say they want to do it again. If you want to talk about people shooting their own civilians, then you only have to look a little closer and you will find that there are Palestinians saying that when Israel gave them orders to evacuate, Hamas shot a lot of them and tried to force them to stay as human shields. Well, if it wasn't a false flag op, then there must have been some kind of stand down order. Thank you, Charlie Kirk, so-called friend of Israel, an apparent expert on the Middle East who's been to Israel many times, clearly not paying that much attention to Israelis. This order, even if it existed, would not have been obeyed, and indeed wasn't, because thousands of people rushed in. It's obvious that there was utter shambolic disorganization, but there was no stand down order. The people who have stood down to make sure that civilians were killed are, oh look, Hamas again. They've built all of these tunnels, and then they specifically scorned journalists who said, but why aren't you allowing civilians to take shelter in your tunnels? Well, that's not what they're for, is it? Why would we do that? Oh, bring forward evidence of rape. There's not enough evidence that people were raped. Well, yeah, because most of the people who were raped were killed afterwards, or sometimes before. Hamas are not looking to leave witnesses, although enough have now come forward, and there were some people who were eyewitnesses in places of hiding, and even left-wing journalists do now seem to agree. So the New York Times and The Guardian have published substantial pieces about this, and it turns out that rape was a predetermined strategy of Hamas, according to the documents that have been seized and the interviews with captured terrorists have uncovered. Oh, nobody was beheaded, it's an exaggeration. No, there are multiple confirmed cases of beheadings. Perhaps at the beginning when they were saying it was hundreds or 50 or 60 or however many various people said at the point of fog of war and utter shock. Yep, perhaps it was not as many as that, but it's quite clear that there were multiple beheadings and choppings off of limbs, people playing around with a breast and keeping it as a souvenir. The kind of stories are so awful that it doesn't matter how many of them there are. It matters that they happened and it matters that they were intentional. It was a part of the act of October the 7th to do these things and to make sure that everybody knew that was what was going on. This is a cult of bloodlust. And a reminder that 75% of Palestinians support it. Another 10% can't quite make up their minds. And there are 15% who really get that maybe it's not such a lovely idea. Oh, that whole baby in the oven thing was a myth too. Well, there were multiple credible witnesses to what they had seen. And again, what we do know is that there were many burnt to a crisp, burnt alive human beings, people trapped in their own homes quite intentionally as they were set fire to. So probably in my view, yes, there was a baby put in an oven. Even if they weren't, people were roasted alive in their homes. Do you really need it to be in an appliance before you think it's disgusting? The mere fact that this is how forensic it has to be to try and pull at some threads to make the whole thing stack up is the worst example of confirmation bias that I think I've ever come across. Ah, but what about all those scenes of burying cars? That all looked so fake, all the bringing together of old cars. No, you can see the number plates. It's pretty obvious that those are the current cars. And they were being brought together so that they could be buried because of the pieces of human smeared all over them and the Jewish requirement to bury all human remains. you want to talk about faking scenes? It is the Palestinians who have been caught repeatedly staging all of these dramatic photos of corpses being dragged from rubble. Or that one rather too pristine teddy bear that seems to have survived a missile strike. Oh, but you targeted the Greek church. You've targeted churches. Why would Israel target a church? Why would Israel want to piss off another 3 or 4 billion people around the world? It is convenient that it does whip up a whole load of new animus. And oh, if it wasn't good enough that the Jews killed Jesus. It is, of course, the Palestinian Muslims who have persecuted Palestinian Christians out of Palestine. Yeah, but Israel bombs hospitals. Well, the first story about it we know was debunked and it turned out to be a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket that went wrong. And we know that they not only lied about who fired it, they not only lied about how many people had died, they lied about the extent of the damage, they lied about every single major factor of that catastrophe. Yes, Israel has had to attack and bomb on occasions schools and hospitals, but it has done so after warning people to get out and explaining this is because Hamas have embedded themselves in a school, in a hospital. Schools and hospitals are not automatically never allowed to be targets. If the enemy decides to make them a base, they become a legitimate target in war. These are very uncomfortable truths for people to face, but this is the reality. And it is the reality under law. Yeah, well, you know, generally you are focusing on damage and not precision. I even heard an IDF guy say this at the beginning of the war. No, you didn't. There's no primary source for this quote, and I've looked really hard. But you've used all these £2,000 bombs. Oh, it's terrible. Yes, because a £2,000 bomb is what's necessary to destroy a hard concrete building on a surface when there's no other means to destroy it. Again, war. And just how many of the thousands of rockets that Hamas built when they could have been doing things to help their own people that they have then fired indiscriminately at civilian targets? How many of those were supposed to be about precision rather than damage? Yeah, well, at least the hostages would be really well treated. Just look at the smiles and how they waved goodbye. Except that these people have now said, well, we were drugged, we were bribed, we were threatened, we had our family still hostage, we had to say and do these things. And it's quite obvious that they were not well treated. They've returned abused, they've returned emaciated, there are stories of them being locked in cages. The Red Cross have, of course, not managed to visit any of them. Yeah, but you mistreated all the Palestinian prisoners. Look at the guy with a broken arm, except it turned out to be a fake broken arm. There were pictures of the same kid being released with his arm in perfect working order. And Sinwar, who was in an Israeli jail for many years, got plenty of education, learned to speak decent Hebrew. I think he did okay from it. Yeah, but Emily Hand learned some manners. Yes, 9-year-old Irish-Israeli Emily Hand learned manners and came out better for it. This was the point at which I really lost my shit with some so-called friends who were posting all of this kind of crap. It's quite obvious that she is massively traumatized by what has happened to her, and this claim is just sick. If you want to talk about what it is that young people in Palestinian territories are learning, you only have to look as far as the indoctrination summer camps of the little kids running around with fake machine guns, talking about how they can't wait to become martyrs. No, but you can't say that kind of thing when Gazans didn't choose Hamas. It's not their fault that there are these extremists in charge. Actually, they voted them in, and there's consistently majority support before and after the 7th of October. Yes, but there are lots of moderates like the Palestinian Authority and UN Relief Works Agency. I already told you about the 3,000 teachers on Telegram from the UN Relief Works Agency. The Palestinian Authority has still not condemned the 7/10 attacks, and they are going to pay martyrs, including the perpetrators of the 7th of October, just like they've paid all the other people who have carried out acts of terrorism against Israelis. Our so-called peace partners, the ones we're supposed to have a two-state solution with, the ones who, after we rid Gaza of Hamas, we are supposed to put in charge. That's what they do. Yeah, but this is all about an anti-apartheid kind of movement. It's not surprising that some of these things will happen and you'll have extremists and violence. Well, it's true, there are some parallels with anti-apartheid. They're both Marxist-Leninist anti-Western subversions of noble causes that made pacts with the devil. In practice, it's Israel itself that is the more anti-apartheid. If you want to have a look at who has the more diverse culture, Israel is the most diverse place in the Middle East. It has a population of 20% who are Palestinian citizens of Israel, or Israeli Arabs, depending on how they themselves wish to define who they are, which may change on a day-to-day basis, and that is their right in a free country, who vote in elections, who have political parties, who have members of the Supreme Court. Where are your Jews in Palestine? Where are your Jews across the Arab world, as Hillel Noyer so wonderfully put in his speech to the UN? Where are your whites? Where are your Christians? Where are your gays? If you have them at all, they're a subjugated, humiliated minority. Oh, Israel banned the Palestine flag. It's another example of how much they hate us and don't want us to exist. Well, that's a nonsense. The Palestinian flag is flown all the time at any number of rallies. It was a huge effort to try and have the last year of anti-government protests not include the Palestinian flag because this was an internal Israeli debate. Meanwhile, there are Israeli flags across the Arab world being kept when they're needed to burn in public. Well, all of this started with Israel faking the number of people who died on the 7th of October, and now they're lying about how many soldiers have died. It's really much more because Hamas are an amazing fighting force. Firstly, Israel revised its numbers down when it looked at the bodies and found that 200 were Hamas dog food. And secondly, we cannot hide the number of dead soldiers. It's not Russia. Israel is a small place. Everybody knows everybody. If somebody dies, people know who it was and where they were. And this is coming from the pro-Hamas contingent, who at the same time willfully believe the ever-growing number of dead as declared by Hamas, all of whom are magically civilians. It's worth pointing out that there doesn't seem to be any separation of who exactly has died from what. So where are all the people who've died of natural causes in Gaza over the last 3 to 4 months? Statistically, there should be 8,000 to 10,000 of them. I'm not seeing that separated out. My guess is that within those 25,000 are all of them. Also, their definition of children magically includes all of the 16 to 18 year old boys who have been co-opted into Hamas and have died. It's very tragic that 16 to 18 year olds have been brainwashed enough to take part in Hamas activities, but nonetheless, if you are in any way fetching and carrying for Hamas, then you're a legitimate target in a war. And whilst we're on numbers, it is accepted that Hamas have a fighting force of 30 to 40,000 men in Gaza. I would point out that the entirety of the British armed forces can barely muster twice that number in a population which is the thick end of 70 million people. Well, but Israel invented Hamas like the US invented ISIS and Al-Qaeda. See, this is a good old-fashioned lie. In the olden days, what they would do is take something that was actually 80% true and just color it with a 20% lie and use that to feed some bad information into the system. It is true that Israel supported Hamas in its early days, but that was before it took up arms. When Hamas was an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood, but not a terrorist organization, Israel used it as a counterbalance to the PLO's influence in the Palestinian territories. We're talking about the 1980s here. In exactly the same way as the claims of the US inventing Al-Qaeda come from its support of the Mujahideen when they were fighting the Russians, and of ISIS as a counterweight to Iranian influence, which, by the way, isn't proven. It seems to have been a consequence of the US pulling out rather than an intention. It's just another way of trying to claim when it's convenient that there's no agency in anything that Hamas or maybe Palestinians or perhaps the wider Arab or Muslim world ever do. A perpetual and total victim complex, which funnily enough is the exact thing, oh look, that they blame Jews and Israelis for. Oh, you're always saying that you're so hard done by and you're the victim. There's fairly empirical proof that Jews are the eternal victim. But one of the reasons why you all hate us is because that's not how we behave on a day-to-day basis. We pick ourselves up, we dust ourselves off, and if necessary, we leave with the clothes on our backs and we go to a new country and we start again and we succeed. And that is actually why you hate us. It's because we don't cry victim on ourselves. That's what you do. You and your pathetic enablers in the West who are doing exactly the same thing. All these stupid little progressive TikTok generation no-hopers are also playing the victim because, well, you aren't willing to accept my 44th gender of the week. These things are all tied together as far as I'm concerned. It's a mentality, or more specifically, a mental illness. So to wrap this up, it is the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and leaders around the Arab and Muslim world who have repeatedly called for and taken actions towards the carrying out of a genocide of the Jewish people, not just, I would be very clear, Israel, the existence of the State of Israel, Israelis, but they have gone after the Jewish community around the world. There were plots foiled in Europe just recently of Hamas trying to murder Jews in Europe. Oh, but I know, it was taken out of the Hamas Charter, the systematic destruction of Israel and all Jews. Yes, it was taken out because it was the only way that the world was prepared to allow the Palestinian Authority and Qatar to prop up Hamas in Gaza so that at least there could be some semblance of normalcy there. And Hamas were required to tone it down a bit. It should be quite apparent from the things that they have said since October the 7th and the very fact of October the 7th that that wish has never gone away. So if people wish, in the light of everything that I have explained, to continue to effectively support Hamas by conflating them with the Palestinian people and failing to put in the really hard work to separate out the Palestinian people from the actions, then yes, if you are a substantial and specific protected group who believe in that, then I wish for your genocide. Not for the death of you as a person, but for the destruction of your culture. You have no place in a free and decent world. Alternatively, you could stop supporting spurious and vexatious cases based on sloppy distortions of language, and then I wouldn't have to speak for a half hour about why I wish to see genocide, because I would be more in a normal frame of mind where I would understand that that's an inappropriate use of the word. But as apparently I'm a helpless victim and you've driven me to a point where I have no other choice, interesting, isn't it? You don't like it when the boot is on the other foot. That's not an argument that's acceptable for Jews to use to justify anything. So I'm releasing this podcast just before the ICJ make their ruling because, frankly, I don't really care which way they rule. The fact that they are even ruling is already a problem in its own right. Just a little level-headed analysis about what I think Israel should have done with the ICJ. I think the fact that they attended and that they submitted and defended in person in the way that they did was a huge tactical error. I think if the court was ever going to rule that this case had no merits, they would have done so either without any Israeli submission, because on its face this case was nonsensical, or with a simple written Israeli submission. I think the fact that they dignified and validated the court and gave it credibility by showing up was an enormous tactical error. There is no win for Israel here. The court is going to rule in one of three ways. The first is incredibly unlikely, which is to say this isn't genocide, go away, which, although that would look like a victory for Israel, nobody who's already set their minds against Israel is going to take their word for it. The second would be the draw, which I think is the most likely outcome, which is that the court says, well, we're going to go away and think about it, so in the interim, we've left it open. It's not genocide. Everyone will say, well, you see, they failed to say no. So even the most likely outcome of not saying it's a genocide at this point, but reserving judgment and going off for a couple of years to think, is a loss for Israel. And of course, the horrific possibility that they actively say, yup, here are interim measures, you must stop immediately because this probably is. All this fits into a wider pattern of the subversion of all of these kind of institutions by the illiberal anti-Western axis of Russia, China, Iran, etc. that's been building. In a previous episode, I talked about the BRICS and why I thought that was beginning to coalesce as a more serious force. This clever manipulation of the old institutions of Western-imposed rules-based order, and of course that happening under the umbrella of Pax Americana, that's all going away, and what is being replaced with is this form of chaos in which those very institutions are being used to try and punish the West for their own more moral behavior. And again, I want to be clear, I know the West is not perfect. There are shades of grey, God forbid, in this world. But it is hard to argue that most people would prefer to live in China or Russia or any one of 50-something autocratic regimes that support China just in Africa than they would in Europe or America, which is why people are trying to get into Europe or America. For the same reasons, however much we may disagree with the Israeli government, with acts of individual Israeli policy. And of course, whilst we are distraught at any mistakes that are made in which people do die in Gaza who don't deserve it, it is why it's incumbent on everyone to understand that Israel is a bastion of Western values, and that if Israel is punished for daring to defend itself and to separate itself from the genocidal blood culture that lives next to it, and for wanting to get rid of that death cult, then this will all come back on you, and it will come back on you much harder because you're much softer than we are. That is one of the big advantages of us having nowhere else to go. I had a thought about this because I'm going back to Israel in the next few days for the first time since the events of October the 7th, and I realized that the one thing that causes me more stress than the idea of living permanently in Israel again is the idea that I might not be able to live permanently in Israel again. Dwell on that. I believe that Hamas is Amalek. I believe that the Palestinian people have the choice to not be Amalek. It is not clear to me that the majority of people have made that choice. I do not wish to see the genocide of the Palestinian people. I wish to see the end of Amalek behavior among the Palestinian people. To draw a different parallel from the Bible, this is about Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah. If we can find enough good people there, then the wrath of God or Israel should not be upon the entirety of Gaza. If we can find those people. Those people could and should include Mahmoud Abbas, leaders of the Arab world, and the so-called pro-Palestinians, who should have spoken up clearly much earlier on to say, whilst we may not love Netanyahu, whilst we're not big Zionists, whilst we believe in whatever solution we believe in, this was all too far. And we understand that the organization that perpetrated this must be removed. That's all they had to say. And then we could have had a nuanced and complex discussion about the exact nature of how that might happen to mitigate the horrific pain of the people who are the unfortunate human shields of Hamas. Unfortunately, those people were nowhere to be seen, and Israel has had to go it alone. But that is part of the game that has been rigged against Israel. It is intentional because the people who are so-called pro-Palestinian are, for the most part, really anti-Israel and to a large extent anti-Semitic. And the Palestinians are just a useful prop in that game. So this is where the original recording of this podcast ended. But thankfully, a few people are now listening to these podcasts, and I'm even getting some very good feedback. So I wanted to unpack a few things that I mentioned earlier in this episode that slipped my mind. Firstly, to explain what is Amalek. In the Bible, there is the story of the most wicked tribe of all, the Amalekites, who basically do exactly the kind of things that Hamas did on October the 7th. Rape, slaughter, humiliation, subjugation, vile acts of barbaric depravity just for the sake of it, doing horrific things purely for the shock and terror factor, and being very proud about it. It is very unusual for anyone to use the injunction to kill Amalek, which goes for everybody in the tribe of Amalek, and it's why you very rarely have heard it used, and nobody uses it, certainly nobody in the Knesset uses it, to mean all the Palestinians. Every reference that I have heard talking about Amalek has been in reference to Hamas. Now, to put it in some perspective, there were rabbis who said that even calling the Nazis the children of Amalek was not really on, because there were some who had more redeeming features. But I think that anybody who carries out or endorses in full the acts of October the 7th, and I'm not talking about the people who in a mealy-mouthed way justify them, but really the people who full-on endorse them, as far as I'm concerned, they are Amalekites, and they are to be obliterated from this earth, whether that means complete reprogramming of their insane brains or physically removing them from this earth. I'm not ashamed to call for their deaths if that's what's necessary, because they have not just called for mine, they have acted to contribute towards mine. Whilst we're on the subject, I use the word Shoah without explaining that that is the Hebrew and Jewish term for the Holocaust. Obviously, the word Holocaust exists, but the capital H Holocaust is the translation into English of what we call the Shoah. I was asked to actually make the Steel Man case for the Palestinians. I think it's worth just putting a context around why the current pro-Palestinian arguments are made the way they are. It's becoming much more common to be able to talk about, without being accused of being a member of the alt-right, the idea that so many different movements in the West, as I spoke about in a previous episode, are built around a victim-oppressor narrative. This often ties into a settler-colonial narrative, etc. And of course, these movements are what we now call intersectional. So you tend to see the same radicals popping up at the furthest reaches of the climate change movement, the pro-Palestinian movement, the equity movement, even the Me Too movement. It's all the same people that keep re-emerging with very similar messages in each sphere. One of the reasons why this whole movement or collective of movements is so problematic in the first place is that they are all individually designed to, and any one of them, if it was really taken to its ultimate objective, has the possibility to entirely pull down the fabric of Western society as we know it. People are beginning to realize that the climate change agenda, taken to its radical conclusion at the speed that they want to, will essentially destroy Western economies, and of course, it's the poorest who will suffer the most from that. We're already seeing the devastating effect of what happens when you take the equity agenda too far on campus, where it originated. Nobody wants to see that in every workplace or every social club or any other environment you care to mention, because it naturally comes at the expense of the thing that we've been trying to build this entire time, which is a meritocracy. We're doing the literal opposite of Martin Luther King's injunction to judge people by the content of their character and not the colour of their skins or other immutable characteristics. This is relevant to the Palestinians because by including them in this completely black and white narrative, what you're doing is creating a kind of dystopia where it doesn't matter how cruelly they behave, because you've decided that they are on the side of right and reason. It all has to be somehow made acceptable, and that means presenting Israel and Israelis and Zionism and probably Jews as the worst devils to justify such behaviours. Naturally, this plays into a general undertone where many people are not already particularly well disposed towards Jews. And this entire culture, as one of my friends puts it very succinctly, is all about people flexing their unearned moral superiority. There has to be an out-group, an other, that are perceived to be in the wrong so that you can enjoy how much you are in the right. And it's a justification for all kinds of force, whether it's the violence of the actions of Hamas on October the 7th and before and after, or in the wider cancel culture that we're now seeing more frequently, or in the so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion movements that are having the effects of driving people out of positions that they are quite entitled to hold and would hold if it was all being done on a meritocratic basis. You really don't want to be a white man in the civil service or a large company because your days are numbered if you are. There's only so far up the tree you're going to climb, unless you can claim some disability or a quirky religion or perhaps change your gender to something unusual. The kind of Kafkaesque or Orwellian situation that we find ourselves in with the Israeli-Palestinian debate is that by trying to homogenize the Palestinian message into something broadly around occupation, 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 and that anything is justified because occupation, when you go to the extremes that they did on the 7th of October, their supporters then find themselves effectively having to go along with that as being the acceptable response to what they perceive to be the occupation. Of course, we can get into the nuances of the fact that Gaza has not been occupied since the Israelis pulled out in 2005. They've had their own elections. They have enough agency that they could have done a lot more with the aid and support that they've had from Israel, from other countries around the world, the EU, the UN, and so on and so on. Not content with oversimplifying the Palestinian narrative to just being about occupation and everything essentially being made acceptable to fit that narrative. It's also the case that they do that with Zionism. Anybody who's looked at Zionism will know that, much like the old joke of two Jews, three opinions, Zionism comes in very many shapes and forms. To be an anti-Zionist, the reason why Martin Luther King again said being an anti-Zionist basically means you're an anti-Semite, is because once you're against the general concept of any form of Zionism, you're excluding 90 to 95% of Jews, and you're putting in danger the other 5 to 10%, even though they may not want a Jewish state in the current form because of various issues to do with their interpretations of the return of the Messiah and such. I'll set aside Nature Carter. I'm quite happy for them to be put in danger. Oh, I should say, Nature Carter are a bizarre ultra-Orthodox sect who are actively in love with Hamas and Iran and turn up at the protests. In case you're wondering who those weird Hasidic people are who are also wearing kafirs, that's who they are. The very definition of useful idiots. So our narrative has also been forcibly simplified to the occupation, and also any time that anyone puts their head above the parapet and say, yes, but Israel is so much more than that, they say, that's what you would say because you don't want to talk about the occupation. People are very disappointed with the idea that not only is the occupation not the daily concern of most Israelis, it's also not the concern of most Palestinians on a day-to-day basis. This is one of the classic things that until you actually go and see what it's like to be in the West Bank, and then you realise most people are just going about their daily lives. The number of checkpoints has been massively reduced. I could get into an entire explanation about how checkpoints are put where they're put, what the real negotiations behind the scenes are and who they are with, because the Palestinian Authority is essentially just a franchise. Anyway, we can go into that another time. But herein actually leads us to what I would do to steel man the Palestinian case. I would set aside the issue of occupation, because I believe that to be a fundamentally negative path. And in fact, everything before the story of occupation is also negative and completely untruthful. This idea that everybody lived in peace and it was all kumbaya under the Ottomans and the British is palpable nonsense. There's a list of massacres as long as your arm of Arabs against Jews. It's always remarkable how the same examples come up every time. Oh, but what about Deir Yassin? Oh, but what about the King David Hotel? And yes, these seem to be mistakes that were made, and I'm using that language very specifically. And again, there are endless podcasts, and I'm not going to go into why I believe those to be mistakes rather than deeply malicious intended acts. But the whole Palestinian narrative rests on essentially the Nakba, which I mentioned earlier, as this catastrophe. But the way in which the Palestinian narrative could be framed today, if they were serious about building a society alongside Israel, would not be based on harking back to the Nakba and using the occupation as their excuses to justify whatever it is that they believe to be acceptable in the course of trying to liberate themselves from the, again, occupation. It's quite amazing that chilling phrases like by any means necessary, or what did you think decolonization was going to look like, or from the river to the sea. It's amazing that people don't seem to understand the resonance of those phrases to anyone, but especially to Jews who have suffered millennia of persecution and who have a particularly sensitive ear for these kind of phrases, especially when they are accompanied by acts of violence and by threats of violence and general menace. When we see the rallies that are taking place, the amazingly mostly peaceful rallies, where they're trashing city centres and ripping down American flags when they're doing their parades in New York, or when they're smearing things on statues in the UK, or just the general absence of any what I would call decorum about the way that they're behaving, the sheer anger and then the sort of gloating about how they know the police won't arrest them, the taunting of the police, none of that makes us think that this is a bunch of peaceful guys protesting in a non-violent way for a Martin Luther King or Mandela type character to emerge and lead the Palestinians into the promised land for all of our sakes. If that were the case, then much like there were for, oh, Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, there would be Jews fighting alongside them in numbers on behalf of the Jewish community, not the so-called the As a Jew Brigade, to help to make that case. And indeed, in the 1990s, that is where most Jews were. We were all thinking, maybe this Arafat guy can change his spots. Maybe we can work with him. He's been given a Nobel Prize. I guess the Americans have vetted him. Someone's keeping an eye on his activities. Maybe these guys are serious about peace. When they looked serious and for 1 minute stopped the continual narrative of, oh, the Nakba, oh, the occupation, and started to talk about something positive and proactive, we were there to work with them. For which trouble we got the second intifada and then the disengagement, and now October the 7th. The so-called cycle of violence. On a macro level, and of course on a micro level, well, Hamas fired rockets because they were annoyed because Israel carried out this raid, which they carried out because somebody fired some guns at somebody, which they did because somebody got killed in a bad incident at a checkpoint, which happened because, and so on. All simplified on their side to occupation, occupation, occupation. Incidentally, I have said for some time that we ought to take a leaf out of their book. We should be simplifying the Hasbara message to recognition, recognition, recognition. Recognize our inherent historic right to be somewhere in the Holy Land with borders and bases to be determined, and start acting accordingly. It's the fact that they have made this a zero-sum game, which the vast, vast majority of Israelis absolutely do not do, including people quite far to the right on the political spectrum, that has made this an intractable problem. The moment you agree this isn't zero-sum, you start to be able to pick your way through to solutions. And that is where the beginning of my steel man case for the Palestinians would be. The honest case for the Palestinians goes something like this. Whilst it's true that in pre-1948 Palestine, there was no local Arab national identity, there was a pan-Arab identity. Nonetheless, a whole variety of countries came into existence in the 20th century, and especially as a consequence of the end of the Second World War and a period of decolonization, especially in the Middle East, with all sorts of arbitrary and artificial borders being drawn up, including, you could argue, the Green Line that was the Armistice Line in 1949 at the end of the Israeli War of Independence. So, as Bob Dylan would say, how many years must the people exist before they are allowed to be free? I would be willing to make the argument on behalf of the Palestinians that whether or not they existed as a group of Palestinians, as we now think of them, as an Arab, broadly Muslim group of Palestinians with a unique local and Palestinian identity, the fact is that they do now exist. And they were de facto brought into existence by the United Nations in the partition plan that the Jews accepted and the Arab world, on behalf of the Palestinians, what we now call the Palestinians, rejected. This has always been the problem, is that the Palestinians exist in a vacuum and were born out of a negative identity. All they are is the thing that they are not. They're not the Jews, and they're not the other Arab countries that got their own identities and statehoods. That then requires them to make all of these huge stretches on what is Palestinian culture. Well, we have the Dabka, well, it's Shakshuka, well, we can give them Edward Said. Although I think probably he owed a lot more to a Marxist-Leninist indoctrination than he did anything to do with something local to British Mandate Palestine, but there we go. The argument is that they do exist, and they should exist, and they should build a positive culture. And funnily enough, the exact example of how you do that, again, is Israel. Israel as a modern state had to be constructed or pre-constructed for a generation or two before it was voted into existence and then fought for its right to that existence in 1948. After the War of Independence, there was a concept called Israeliut, Israeliness, where there had to be the creation, an artificial creation, or at least let's say a synthesis, of different Jewish cultures, along with an understanding of what it might look like to be indigenous. So, for example, the suppression of the use of Yiddish and Ladino as languages of Jewish culture of standing in favor of modern Hebrew. If I take the things that make me the most uncomfortable about some of the behaviors of Israelis, whether it's settlers or the IDF or the government or whoever, it tends to be at the exact points where my instinct says they've butted up against actual Palestinian culture, things that are what the indigenous people would do. People often talk about that in our neighborhood, it's the tale of Solomon's baby, where the two so-called mothers come and say, I think this is my child, and the other one says, this is my child, and Solomon says, okay, I'll cut the baby in half. And the real mother says, I'd rather the other mother has it than that I see my baby die. And I think that is how we're supposed to look at it. So anytime I see these stories of olive trees being uprooted or people being chased off the land when all they're doing is giving pasture to some goats, and I just think, is that really, I mean, quite literally, the hill you want to die on? So I think that if this was about the love of the land, then that would be an authentic story to tell if you believe that you are the indigenous or an indigenous people. And it would also mean that you respect when you see other people who are showing the same love of the land, whether they arrived a year ago or 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, doesn't matter. It's how they treat the place that ought to matter. Which is why I find it greatly ironic that Greta Thunberg is all over the Palestinian thing, despite the fact that they really do not respect the land to a great extent. They pollute, they don't protect the aquifers, they don't recycle, you name it, they don't do it. And that's despite the fact that Israel has tried to assist, that there are projects from NGOs to do this. It isn't in the culture. And I'm afraid to say this, but if you travel through most of the Arab world, certainly the 2 or 3 Arab countries that I've been to, but I hear this from other people, unless you're going to pristine city-states like Dubai, there is a, let's politely say, different relationship to what you do with litter and pollution and general environmental care. And no, I don't think you can use the excuse of, well, they have no choice, they're poor because Israel, dot, dot, dot. Again, you cannot continue to blame the occupation for everything. It's a pathology and it doesn't work. Occupation cannot be a byword for we have no agency whatsoever. In many ways, it's the other way around, because if you look at where Israel tried to de-occupy, if you look at the disengagement from Gaza, or if you look at the Oslo Accords, in which the Palestinian Authority have day-to-day control over the civil affairs of 95% of Palestinians in the West Bank. And now have a look at the popularity and approval ratings of the Palestinian Authority. Look at the record of competence. Every time that these people have been given agency, they have squandered it. So it's much easier to claim, well, we don't have any agency and we never did, it's just the Israelis' fault. A steel man argument for the Palestinians would be, we're ready for agency, we're looking for the right partners, we understand that other people have been custodians of this land, whether we like them or not, whether we want them to be here or not, they're actually the right role model for us. And we think that we can share the land with such people. And then we can have a discussion about, is that a two-state solution? Is it a confederation? Is it one-state solution? Maybe it's an iterative process. But it starts with a recognition that other people, for whatever reason, may have attained rights to be here in the same way as we have formed into a state in waiting, just like the Jews did in the 1880s until the 1940s. So did we from the 1940s until the 2020s. The reason you never hear such a steel man argument being made is because it's actively dangerous to renounce or denounce terrorism and corruption inside the Palestinian community. And it's also not going to make you popular in the pro-Palestinian community, because it involves giving up your unearned moral superiority. It involves you saying, I have to work to have enough moral high ground to both forgive the other and to make reasonable requests of the other that they share with me. It is that exact premise which is what was followed by Herzl and then Ben-Gurion and by all of the other leaders of Israel as it was going through its birthing pains, the constant compromising from what they believed to be the birthright of the Jewish people, from what was promised in the Balfour Declaration, and in a whole series of other agreements and negotiations with both Western powers and the dregs of the Ottoman Empire. I often say that the fundamental problem of this conflict is that Jews and Israelis are incapable of accepting and having the mindset that they have won and enforcing their victory, and Arabs, and to a degree I would say Muslims, have a cultural inability to accept loss, especially at the hands of non-Arabs, non-Muslims. Usually it just makes them double down rather than to have a moment of introspection. This is unfortunately increasingly true of non-Arab, non-Muslim supporters of the Palestinian cause. The thrall of moral superiority is in fact so strong that it pulls people into this cause with surprising ease. On a recent trip to Porto, I met a small group of pro-Palestinian demonstrators who said that they had been out every night. And I asked, oh, since when? And the ringleader said, oh, since October the 7th. And I said, that's funny. Are you saying that you were in support of the victims of Hamas's terrorism on October the 7th, and then after that you were more in favor of the victims of what you perceive to be the Israeli genocide in response? And he said, oh, no, I meant we were here since October the 8th. Of course he did. We can't have any grey areas or nuances in our moral superiority. It can only be a one-way street. Not even crocodile tears for the dead Jews. This was from a guy who later claimed to actually be Jewish. And he said, oh, a lot of people call me a self-hating Jew. And I thought, it's not just that you hate yourself. It's not just that you even hate Jews. It's that you effectively hate humanity. Speaking of which, and while we're here, I may as well expand a little more now that the ICJ ruling has in fact come out. As predicted, it was essentially a draw. They didn't really rule on the exact subject matter that the South Africans had so spuriously brought. They basically said Israel should report to us to confirm that they're doing all the things that Israel has said it's been doing all along, i.e. not massacring civilians, i.e. not aiming at civilians, i.e. trying to provide some form of humanitarian aid, and so on and so forth. As usual, because everything has to be seen in a completely black and white way, the South Africans and the pro-Palestinian community claimed this immediately as some enormous victory. But then that fits the TikTok generation, who are incapable of actually reading a document properly or watching the full judgment, which took an hour. Much easier just to swallow 30 seconds of Jeremy Bowen being incredibly smug about it after the fact. The full version of Bin Laden's letter to America definitely goes after pretty much the entire readership who are currently glorifying what they think is in that letter, but they're too slovenly to bother to read 12 or 13 pages of his diatribe. It was probably ever thus, but I do feel that one of the big problems that we have in the West is that most sophisticated ideas take an hour's podcast or a reading of a book to unpack, and all of these simplified notions that come from the broadly other side can be put into a tweet or a TikTok. It's why we see such an incredible dichotomy in the opinions on this particular conflict between the 18 to 24s and pretty much everybody else. And I believe that the ICJ ruling has been given exactly because what it allows that generation and the fanatics to do is to seize on it as being some form of condemnation of Israel, that it is carrying out acts of genocide. And for anyone who's a serious reader of texts to understand that that's absolutely not what they've done. They've reserved their right to later try and find out whether that is the case, based on evidence they've asked Israel itself to present. They will have on their consciences, or they should if they had a conscience, all of the violence that will now be wrought against Jewish communities around the world, and the raising up a notch of the protests and rallies, because now they're able to try and point towards the ICJ as having not said that Israel is genocidal. Again, in the dystopia that we live in, when the other side are openly and proudly genocidal by word and deed. And a quick reminder that the Palestinian Authority still haven't condemned any of this and are going to pay salaries to the people and the families of the perpetrators of October the 7th. Which is, incidentally, I think, the largest line item of the Palestinian Authority budget, the payment of money to convicted terrorists and the families of those who died causing terrorism. Let that sink in and realize that when you are shilling for the Palestinian cause as it currently is, as opposed to making a positive steel man case with real world implications of how difficult it is to achieve proper statehood, that's what you're actually backing. All of the cheap comparisons with Israel's history do not pass even the slightest test. The big difference is that when Israel knew it was coming into existence, there was what I would call our Altalena moment. The Altalena was a ship carrying guns and personnel of the Irgun right-wing militia, and the forces of Haganah and Palmach, the left-wing militias, actively turned their guns on this ship because it refused to come under the joint command that had been in principle agreed. And it took the intervention of Menachem Begin, you know, the guy who they say is a terrorist, to say, civil war between us? Absolutely not. And he was the one who said, don't resist, just come on shore, bring the arms with and we'll work it out. I have yet to see the Palestinians have their Altalena moment. But then nobody's encouraging them to, because again, once you've established that you are the morally superior side, everything you do is completely acceptable and has to be made to be acceptable. There can be no recognition that you screwed anything up or that individuals acting in your name did something abhorrent that you ought to quite rightly, at this point, renounce. See, that's the complication of genuine statehood. It comes with the responsibility of holding yourself up to the light and being able to live with the errors that you made in the past. Or indeed things that were not at the time errors, they were horrible truths and horrible realities. I don't deny the existence of the Nakba. It must have been awful to be an Arab in this area in 1948, and the choices that you would have had to have made, and the pressure that will have been put on you in different ways by other Arab countries, by people in your community, by the soft power of Jews, because they probably didn't really want you to stay around, and of course, individual acts of violence that were designed to try and push you to leave. No one is denying, or no one should deny, that such things took place. But you can see all the shades of grey in a 30-second synopsis. Accepting the shades of grey is the first part of any good steel man argument for the Palestinians, just as it should be for Israel. And I know very few people who are Israel right or wrong. We want to have the hour-long discussion. This coda to my podcast is already running to half an hour because of the need to try and unpack and articulate these things at the nuanced length that is required, because these are complicated ideas. This is a good moment to wrap up the episode, and I will try and honour my parents, especially given that this is the week where we read the portion of the Torah that was my bar mitzvah portion, which includes the Ten Commandments. And at the time I said that the hardest one was honouring my father and mother. So I will just leave a new Easter egg, because they didn't like the last one where I signed off with a swear word. So hi mum and dad, hope you got to the end of this. And I will be back in another week with a new episode. I think this is going to be a weekly thing, and your feedback is most welcome. If I don't manage to come and re-edit, then I will try and issue little short update episodes based on questions and requests that people had. Thank you very much.